But before we actually get going, I wanted to mention something in this morning, but kind of ran out of time. So I'll eat into our time right now just for 2 minutes to show you something. It was really, really cool. So what we had seen is an expression for 1 plus x to the n is equal to 1 plus n over 1x plus n over 1. We had seen some series expansion like that. And that expression was derived originally for non-negative integer values of n, but then we discovered, at least through working through some examples, that that expression actually works for numbers that are not non-negative integers. So like a number like a half or negative one or something like that. Okay, so all real numbers. And in fact, it also works for complex numbers and so on and so forth. Okay, so that idea of extending mathematical expressions, you know, pushing them into other domains of validity and seeing how far you can push things is very, very important. So a good example of that is called dimensional regularization. So there's, so the electron is this spinning particle. So it's a little bit like a tiny spinning top, and it has electric charge. And so it's a little bit like electric charge swirling around. If you have electric charge swirling around, electric charge moving around in a loop, what do you have? A magnet. Okay, so the electron, not only does it have electric charge, it also acts like a tiny bar magnet. Okay, and the strength of that magnet is can be calculated theoretically. Okay, so classical calculations give you a number like 2. The number is 2, okay, in whatever units. Okay, exactly 2. Okay, but it was known, you know, through measurements and expected to be different from 2 due to quantum corrections. So the actual number, I don't know the actual number off the top of my head, but it's something like, you know, it's something like that. It's slightly different from 2. Okay, so this is classical. This here is quantum corrections. Okay, so so people said, well, okay, so we know how to do these quantum corrections. Quantum field theory came along. We'll talk a little bit about that or whatever, So they had some idea of how to do this calculation. And they did the calculation, and they found out that the number is 2 plus a correction. And the correction turned out to be infinity. 2 plus infinity. Okay, so that's just stupid. Okay, so something's clearly wrong. Okay, and so what's going wrong is has to do with, so yesterday, Padam mentioned some mathematical inconsistencies and so on. So in quantum field theory, there are these singularities which appear. And a singularity is like that kind of singularity that we saw this morning with a function just blowing up to infinity like that. So it's a singularity kind of like that. And I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but anyways, the short of the long story is something like what you can do is this quantum correction. You can do something called dimensional regularization. There are different regularization techniques, but one is dimensional regularization, where you say that the dimension of space-time, instead of being just the integer 4, you know, 3 space and 1 time, is 4 plus epsilon, where epsilon is a small number. So it's like the dimension is 4.05 of space-time. And then you do all the calculation, you do all the mathematics, with the intention at the end of the day of setting epsilon equal to 0. Okay, so what you get is 2 plus, this is super, super rough, okay, this is not actually rigorous in any way, I'm just trying to get across the gist of the idea. What you get is something that looks like this. Some number, like, I don't know, like 16 pi divided by epsilon is the first term, plus some finite number, like 0.0005276, plus some numbers, like, you know, 2.6 times epsilon plus 5.7 times epsilon squared and so on. So it's something like that. Okay, so when you set epsilon equal to 0, well, that term just blows up. Okay, that's where the infinity comes from. Okay, and so by that there are clever ways, which are far beyond what we're going to talk about here, clever ways to argue that this term can be subtracted, clever ways to subtract this term. Okay, so then this term disappears. This term that causes that singularity, you've identified it by going from integer to non-integer dimension of space-time, extended the mathematics, identified where it comes from, found a clever and sensible way to remove that term, And then at the end, you set epsilon equal to zero. That term disappears, that term disappears, all those higher order terms disappear, and you're left with a finite correction. And then, lo and behold, that finite correction agrees with experimental results to an accuracy of like 8, 9, 10 decimal places. It's just freaky. That kind of freaky stuff is done in physics all the time. Okay. So that's just sort of an add-end to what we were talking about this morning. Mathematics is extremely powerful, extremely powerful. Once you can cast your ideas in the language of mathematics, then you can do all kinds of things with it. Yeah.
You're not telling that number. It's not as or is it something different?
No, this is actually unitless. So it's comparing the ratio of two magnetic moments, the magnetic moment of the electron to the fundamental unit of magnetic moment. And so that ratio is dimensionless. It just says that the electron is twice the fundamental unit of magnetism in quantum, basically. Okay, but it's actually very weak. It's much less than 2 tenths of 1 way, way weaker. Okay, so why don't we shift gears into special relativity? So what I wanted to show you was just a bit of an intro to special relativity. So we start with Einstein. Okay. Or use Einstein's head. And we put Einstein's head on, say, a Da Vinci body like this. And then we give Einstein some clocks and a ruler. Okay, so Einstein, we're talking about space and time. So Einstein is going to need to measure space using a ruler and measure time using those plots. I wonder if I could just turn this down a bit more so we can see this more. Oh, that's all dark now, isn't it? Okay, let me turn it back up. Okay. Yeah. Anyways, don't want to be scared of the dark. Okay. So there's Einstein, and he's got his plots and ruler there. And we're going to give ourselves a clock. Our reference clock and our reference ruler. Now, as it stands, Einstein is not moving relative to us. So Einstein's clocks, these are three identical clocks. They're all ticking at the same rate, and they're all in sync with each other. And Einstein's sense of space is the same as our sense of space. His ruler, these are two identical rulers, and when we look at his ruler, it is the same length as our ruler, and vice versa. Okay, so nothing interesting is happening. Okay, so now we're going to make Einstein move. Einstein and his two clocks and ruler are going to drift across our scene. So he's on a skateboard or something like that, sliding across our through our space. He's moving through our space. Okay, and we're going to notice that there are interesting things happening with Einstein's clocks and his ruler relative to our clocks and ruler. Okay, so I'm going to let Einstein move here, and I want you to point out the ways in which the moving Einstein and his clocks and ruler differ from what we had before. What do you notice?
Lower. The clocks are no longer in sync.
Okay, the clocks are no longer in sync, right? So the clock in Einstein's right hand on our left is 15 seconds ahead of the other clock. Let's see here. So that one's 30, that one's 45. Okay, what else?
Okay. They're both going slower than the one.
Yeah, so both of Einstein's clocks, while they're going at the same rate with respect to each other, they're both going slower than this clock, by about half the speed, not exactly half the speed. What else? And everything's smushed together, okay? So he's been contracted in the direction of motion, in this direction. So his ruler and everything else about him are squished to exactly half their width from where they were before. Okay, so three basic effects. The difference in the clock reading, they're not synchronized, is called relativity of simultaneity. And the fact that the clocks are moving slower, the moving clocks are moving slower than our stationary clock here is time dilation. And of course, there's also length contraction. Okay, so this little animation shows all three effects all together. Now, I'd like to point out just a couple of things about this. So first of all, from Einstein's perspective, none of this is happening. If we were to run and catch up with Einstein and look over his shoulder, we would see that his clocks are in sync with each other. He says his clocks are in sync. When one reads 12, the other reads 12. There's no time dilation happening for him. Okay? If when he was at rest, his clocks were ticking at a rate of one tick every heartbeat, when we run and catch up with him and look over his shoulder, those clocks are still moving at a rate of one tick per heartbeat. Okay? And his ruler, there's no length contraction for Einstein. When we're standing with Einstein, his ruler is still the normal length. Like he's still 2 meters high and 1 meter wide between the clocks. Okay, so nothing has changed from Einstein's perspective. I mean, that's easy to see because we could also, instead of us staying at rest and putting Einstein adrift, we could have just left Einstein at rest with just his ordinary clocks and ruler, nothing changes, and we set ourselves adrift this way. Okay, and then we take the point of view, no, it's us that's at rest looking at Einstein moving that way. Okay, so nothing is different for Einstein. Okay, but when we look at Einstein, who is drifting by us like this, we see all of these effects. Okay, the effects that are relative to us. Effects on time relative to our clock, effects of space relative to our space. Okay, so one thing I guess I just want to point out that this effect here is not any kind of an optical illusion. It has nothing to do with while light we're seeing, we're actually using light to view Einstein and this and that. And so light takes so and so much time to get here and back. It's nothing like that at all. If I were to physically watch Einstein drifting by us like this and say touch both of his clocks at the same time, he's to go like this. And touch both of them at the same time, the distance between my two hands when I'm physically touching both clocks simultaneously is actually less than 1 meter. It's actually like this half distance here. So physically, Einstein occupies less of our space than his own space. Nothing's different for Einstein. He still occupies the same amount of his own space as before. But for us, Einstein occupies half of the space, half of the physical space. We can put him in a box. We can put him in a smaller box. He physically occupies less of our space. Okay? And also, these clocks are reading different times for us. They're reading the same time for Einstein, but different for us. So again, when I go like this,
touch both clocks simultaneously, the clock that I'm touching with my left hand is, say, at 12:15, and the clock I'm touching with my right hand simultaneously is only at 12. Okay, and so it's not an optical illusion. I can actually feel the position of those hands, the hands of those two clocks, with my hands. Okay, and they're reading different times. Okay, so quite literally, the clock that I'm touching with my left hand is in the future of the clock that I'm touching with my right hand, from Einstein's perspective. So what does Einstein see? I go like this, touch both clocks like this. What Einstein sees is I touch this clock first, then this clock, hence the difference in time there. Okay, so from our point of view, we're going like this. From his point of view, we're doing this, then this. Okay, that's called relativity of simultaneity. And that also helps to explain this length contraction. Okay? Like if Einstein is drifting by like this and we touch, then he says from his point of view, we are drifting this way. Okay? And what he sees is first we touch this clock and then move, because we're moving, and then touch this clock. So what he sees is our hands are closer together like this, and they first touch this clock, and then we drift, and then they touch this clock. From our point of view, we've touched both clocks at the same time, but from his point of view, our hands are closer together, we touch this clock, then this clock. So you see how, because of this relativity of simultaneity and the drift that happens in between, our hands are actually closer together. It's no wonder to Einstein that we see length contraction, because he says, well, you didn't touch the clocks at the same time. Duh. Okay, like you touch this way, you're drifting. You touch this clock first and then drift it over and then touch this clock. You had to have had your hands closer together. So we're not making a proper measurement of the distance between those clocks. Okay, so from Einstein's perspective, it's obvious that we're going to see length contraction. But nevertheless, this length contraction is physical. It's really physical. He really is occupying that lesser amount of space in our space. Okay? So those are just a couple of points to do with special relativity, which you all know, which I just want to show graphically before we get going here. Yeah. Yeah, so you are actually touching his clocks. So you're touching that clock face and then that clock face. How? I'm not really sure exactly how you mean universal. So, yeah, so you're touching, yeah. That's right. So the contracted and the fact that the relativity of simultaneity, this clock first, then this clock, are intimately connected and you can't separate them. They're all part of the same phenomenon. So basically there's sort of this, and I'll show you in a second. We can think of space-time as sort of space and time being combined together into this kind of space-time cube. And the effect of motion is to sort of rotate this cube. I'll say that in a second. But all I want to say is that those effects, both so all three effects, the fact that the clocks read different times, this relativity of simultaneity, the length contraction, and the time dilation, the slowing of the clocks, all three effects are intimately tied together. They're all three parts of a closed circle. They all rely on each other for self-consistency. See, I mean, like for example, Einstein here is he's contracted. Okay? If he were to measure our velocity, okay, then he would say, okay, well we are moving from here to here in a certain amount of time. Okay, but his length needs to be contracted by the same amount that his time is contracted, so that he reckons that our velocity, how fast we're moving past him, is the same as the speed that we reckon that he is moving past us. The relative velocity is the same. So we see Einstein moving to the right with a speed of 10 meters per second. Einstein sees us moving to the left with a speed of 10 meters per second. Okay, in order for that to be true, I mean, that obviously has to be true. If you start, say, compressing space, then you also have to dilate time in order for the velocities to match. So all three of those effects are all tied together. They're all part and parcel of the same effect. So it doesn't in any way define any kind of universal reference frame. It'll become much clearer as we go along. Yeah. So he sees you touching them at these times. So when you, so this clock goes by, and I go like this, that's 30 and 45. Einstein will say that you touch that clock when my two clocks read 30, and you touch that clock when my two clocks read 45. And so he will see this at 30. He'll wait 15 seconds. Both clocks are synchronized. They'll move both to 45, and then you'll hit 45. Yeah, you hit this clock first, then this one, from this perspective. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it does. It actually happens. So that's right. So if I had like two clocks on and I was like walking like this, then you guys would see that they're out of sync.
take you running from there to there and you can put it on slow motion.
Yeah.
You can actually see that.
Well, you'd need very accurate clocks. So the effect is small. The effect becomes very large and pronounced when the speeds are close to the speed of light, right? Anything that's an appreciable fraction of the speed of light, you're going to notice these effects. And of course, that's why it took so long for this to be discovered, is that our day-to-day experience, even the space shuttle, as I said this morning, is like 0.0000% the speed of light. Like, it's very, very small. Everything you see in these are very slowly. Until we started building particle accelerators, which routinely now accelerate particles to 99.99999999% speed of light. Okay? And now these effects are really dramatic. The slowing of time, the contraction, all of these effects are easily observed. So that they're definite facts. I mean, this is one of the most accurately known experimental facts about our universe. So like the most decimal places kind of thing, facts that are known. Things that we think we know. Okay, so I wanted to say one more thing about this. So what it essentially did is it changed our perspective of what space and time actually are, and that's what the subject of these special relativity lectures are. So it gave us the sense that space and time. So what Einstein really did is he unified space and time. So they're not the same thing. Space and time are different things in the same way that the x direction is different from the y direction, but he unified them together into a whole, and we can think of it roughly like kind of like a space-time cube. So space-time is the thing, and space is just one face of that thing, and time is just another face of that thing. And normally, we're used to thinking, like in our Newtonian worldview, we're used to thinking in terms of, you know, either just space or just time. Okay, but when something is moving past us, like Einstein is moving past us, then his sense of space and time, his space-time cube, gets sort of rotated, tilted, with respect to ours. So that if this is just space for us, it's space and time for Einstein. So what I mean is, when we go like this and touch both of Einstein's clocks, like that, simultaneously, and measure the distance between Einstein that way, and say, oh, yes, he's only half a meter, whatever, right? So when we measure that distance, when we make that measurement, what are we using? We're using a ruler. That's it. We're just measuring a space distance between two points at the same time. So we use a ruler to make that measurement. But from Einstein's perspective, he needs both a ruler and a clock to figure out what it is we've done, to measure what it is we've done. Because from his perspective, we're going like this. So first of all, our hands are a certain distance apart, which he can measure with his ruler. But also, he notices this clock was touched first, then a little while later, this clock was touched. He times how long that takes, that 15 seconds or whatever between. So in order to measure what we did using just a ruler, Einstein needs a ruler and a clock. Okay, so his space-time cube is rotated relative to ours. Okay, but ultimately, space and time are really just different aspects of the same thing, of this unified kind of space-time cube. Okay, enough of that. Let's actually start with some stuff. Does that make sense? Okay, so we can have a sense of absolute space, absolute time. And what Einstein did is he changed that to a sense of relative space and relative time. So we're going to be talking a little bit about space-time diagrams. How many of you have drawn space-time diagrams? So a couple of you. Okay, so good. So this is largely new, and you're gonna like this. So this is probably the most useful way to understand special relativity, a really, really good way of introducing all these ideas. Okay, so
Okay, let me actually just read for you Newton's sense of absolute time and absolute space. So this is from Newton's Principia. So absolute, true, and mathematical time in and of itself and of its own nature, without reference to anything external, flows uniformly and by another name is called duration. And then blah, 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 blah. So basically what that means is if you have someone here standing here, you know, and they throw this ball like this. And so what we've got is a ball in motion like this, and we've got some clock here. So this person has a clock which goes tick, 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 tick. And this ball, time also elapses for this ball. If you were strapped to that ball, you would experience time elapsing. So if we strap a wristwatch or a clock to that ball, maybe that time would be ticking for that baseball. And what Newton was saying is that when 1 second elapses for this person, 1 second elapses for all clocks in the universe. Okay? 1 second elapses for this clock, 1 second elapses for the clocks that the Martians have on Mars, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that time is like this great grandfather clock up in the sky, and everything is in sync with that. Okay? It doesn't mean that all the clocks are synchronized. Like, you know, this could be 12 noon when that reads like 3 p.m. or whatever. What I mean is when 1 second elapses for this, 1 second elapses for that, and for all other clocks in the universe. Okay, and what Einstein showed is, well, no, it's not like that. There's actually, time moves at a different rate for this clock relative to this clock. Okay, so the moving Einstein, we saw that his clocks were moving at a slower rate than this stationary clock. Okay, so the central thing that special relativity did is it broke that idea of universal time. Okay, so special relativity, so universal time, absolute time. Okay, was broken by special relativity. That's the main lesson here. That's the main thing that Einstein had to struggle with, was to get rid of that. Newton had this idea of absolute space. So just reading from his Principia again, the definition of absolute space. So absolute space of its own nature without reference to anything external always remains homogeneous and immovable, and then blah, 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 big flowery language. And then, for example, if the Earth moves, the space of our air, which in a relative sense and with respect to the Earth always remains the same, will now be one part of the absolute space into which the air passes, now another part of it, and thus the change, and thus will be changing continually in an absolute sense. Okay, so what does that mean? So we've got the sun over here, and we've got the Earth's orbit here, and that's the Earth. Here is an object in motion. And Newton had this sense that there is sort of this frame of reference, which is absolute rest. And for example, it might be the sun. So the sun is at absolute rest in this absolute space, or is at rest in this absolute space. And then anything moving with respect to the sun would be moving in absolute space in Newton's mind. So in his mind, he pictured the Earth at this instant of time, at this instant of universal time, occupying some amount of that space. The volume of the Earth, the rocks of the Earth, were filling that volume of absolute space. And then, like, you know, a day later, according to universal time, the Earth is now over here. And so the Earth no longer occupies that region of absolute space. It now occupies that region of absolute space, and so on. So things were in motion in absolute space, occupying different positions in absolute space. So so that concept is also addressed in special relativity, and there's more of a focus on relative space. Okay, so but the main thing is this abolition of the idea of universal time. Okay, so blah 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 blah. Let's start with some space-time diagrams. All right. Okay, so the main thing with a space-time diagram is the recognition that, sure, objects can move in space, Sometimes they're not moving in space. The space of this room, this object is not moving. Now it's moving and so on. So they can move or not in space. But also, objects always inexorably move through time. Okay, so even if this object is not moving in space, it's just sitting there. If I strap a wristwatch to that thing, it's going to be moving through time. If this is a plant, it's going to be growing. It's going to be like moving through time. So even objects at rest in space are always moving through time. And also, if they're moving, they're also moving through time. If I strap a wristwatch to this thing and throw it around the room, that wristwatch will continue to turn. Okay, and so time will elapse for this eraser, and no matter how it's moving around. It might be affected by the motion, you know, relative to us, but time is always, so objects move not only in space, but also in time. That's the huge, huge, important shift in thinking. So. So they move not only in space, but also in time. And so when we draw pictures like this, okay, we're used to drawing pictures like this of objects moving in space. Okay, so I've taken this baseball and I've pitched it across the room, and we draw a trajectory like that, and we say, oh, this object is moving in space. At one time, what time? Universal time. From this big great grandfather clock and in the sky kind of time or whatever. At one time, the object was here, and next time it was here, next time it was here, and so on. But we draw its trajectory just in space. And we don't really talk so much about how it's moving in time. We don't really usually think about clocks attached to it and those clocks evolving, those clocks turning, those clocks reckoning the passage of time as it moves. So what's required in special relativity to really understand it properly and most easily is to show object's motion not only in space, but explicitly show its motion also in time. Okay, so let's do some examples of that. So we'll start with a picture down here of just an object's motion in space, and then we'll translate that to the object's motion in space and time. Okay, so here we've got Alice. Alice is down here, and she is just standing there. Okay, and so her space is this line here. We're always going to deal with just one-dimensional spaces plus one time. Okay, so we're dealing with two-dimensional diagrams all the time. So Alice's space is just along this line. So we'll call this her x-axis. And we'll put a little subscript A to indicate that this is Alice's x-axis. This is her sense of space. Okay, and she's got a clock here. And a clock tick, 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 tick. Okay, so this would be the usual kind of just space-only picture of Alice's trajectory through space. In this case, pretty simple. She's just standing there. But how could we indicate in a diagram her motion also through time? Straight up? Okay, so we might draw a line straight up. Okay, so let's make another graph just above it here. Alice's, a copy of Alice's x-axis up here. But we also show Alice's motion now through time. So let's suppose that that this over here describes, this point describes Alice when her clock reads zero. Let's put like a little zero there. Okay, when Alice's clock reads one, has her position changed? No, so she's still in the same position, but we need something to distinguish this position from the position when her clock reads, or the event when her clock reads one. So we'll put it, say, up there. Okay, so here her clock, this little dot here represents Alice when her clock reads one. Now this represents Alice when her clock reads two, and so on. Okay, so there's a line here like this. And this line, this is called Alice's world line. World line. So really what it is it's a picture of her clock. So we'll call this T, time, according to Alice. Okay, so that's that. So that's easy. Okay, so now let's suppose we put someone else in the figure here. So in Alice's space, Alice notices that, say, Bob is located over here. And Bob is at rest with respect to Alice some distance away. Okay, and he's also got a clock. Okay, so how are we going to draw Bob's world line, his motion through space and time in this picture? What would we do? Yeah. Just a straight up line that's pushed over. So over here, say. Okay, and so Bob's clock, when Alice's clock reads zero, Bob's clock does not necessarily read zero. Bob's clock doesn't have to be in sync with Alice's clock, so maybe it reads, you know, seven. Okay, so if Bob's clock reads seven here, see a straight line going across, what does Bob's clock read here? How many say eight? How many are really sure it's eight? What if I said, that sitting beside Alice is a desk? Would that change your answer? Ah. How? What's changing? What? Yeah, the curvature of space. Curvature of space and time. Actually, time is warping. It's the most significant effect. So this object is a massive object, and it's standing next to Alice and Bob here. And it turns out that massive objects warp time. They warp space as well, but in this case, more interesting is that they warp time, such that time moves more slowly for Alice than it does for Bob. So Alice's clock will be essentially reading time or ticking time more slowly relative to Bob's clock. Okay, so in fact, if there were a massive object there, then Alice's clock is slower, Bob's clock is faster, and so it would be, see, Bob's clock is faster, and so when Alice's clock reads one, Bob's would need more than one, so it would be down like that. Okay, so, but let's just imagine that we don't have a desk there, and we're just in a space that's free of any other massive objects, and we ignore the mass of Alice and Bob. Then, yeah, it's reasonable to assume that when 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for Bob. But I just wanted to point out that that's an assumption. That's an assumption which happens to be true when there's no other massive objects around, but when there are massive objects around, it's no longer true. Okay, so we have to be very careful in special relativity about what assumptions we are making. Okay, so anyways, it turns out that when there are no other massive objects around, this is a good assumption and in fact true. So Bob's clock reads 8 here, reads 9 here, reads 10 here, and so on. Okay, so this axis here represents Bob's clock at various instants of time. So it's Bob's time axis. We'd call it that. Okay, so let's add someone else to the picture here. Okay, so now this person here is running. Okay, so this is Cleopatra, and she is running. She's running to the right. Okay, how would I draw her world line in this picture? Kind of a diagonal, kind of to the right, because as time elapses for Alice and Bob, so as time is going on, they see Cleopatra moving to the right. So there's this and this. So it's basically a diagonal. Okay, and so it'll look something like this. Okay, now let's suppose that Cleo's clock reads zero. Exactly when Alice's clock reads zero. We'll talk about synchronization later. It's a little bit subtle, but let's just assume that. So then the question is, what does Cleo's clock read there? Does it read one, or does it read greater than one or less than one? Let me say more than one. Let me say less than one. So it's actually less than one, because as we saw in that little animation there, Cleo's clock is going to be moving slow relative to Alice and Bob's clock. And so when 1 second has elapsed for Alice and Bob, less time will have elapsed for Cleo. And so her 1 second is maybe up here. Okay? And then her 2 seconds will be exactly the same distance along here. Assuming this is a straight line. Okay, so up like that. This is 2 seconds, and then this here is 3 seconds, and so on. So this is Cleo's clock over here. Okay, so it read the same time as Alice and Bob's, or as Alice's clock, at this point here, but then later on, because of time dilation, it's reading less and less time. Yeah. Because of their motion. So what I'm saying is, let's ignore the mass of Alice, Bob, and Theo. Let's imagine that they're like essentially point particles. And just time is elapsing for these point particles, and we totally ignore the effect of mass. Totally. And then this effect is true. If we now consider mass, well, then it gets much more complicated. And that then gets into the area of general relativity. Who's they? Oh, yeah, you would look at both. You would look at both special relativistic effects and general relativistic. Like when you're talking, say, GPS, GPS is you know, Earth here, GPS satellites here, going around, there's 24 of them or whatever. Here's a GPS satellite, and this thing here there are two things affecting the time. One is the fact that it's in motion relative to you down here. So there's this kind of special relativistic time dilation, but also the Earth warps the time around it in such a way that the time moves more quickly up here than it does down here, and we'll talk more about that. So there are two effects on time here, and both of those effects are about equally important in the GPS, turns out, just out of a coincidence. In fact, and they're opposite. They nearly cancel, in fact. The effects are, but they don't cancel, and the difference between those effects is large enough so that if you didn't account for those effects, the GPS would fail in about 2 minutes. So they're very real effects, both of them. There was a question here?
Cleopatra, the time gaps, is it as you go further along in time, do the gaps increase, or it stays constant but just larger than A and B?
Okay, so that's a good question. So the separation between 0 and 1, that's the same as the separation between 0 and 2, and between 2 and 3, and so on. So what do you think? What is your guess, your initial guess?
No.
Do you think that they would change? Okay, so what if we said, that
Cleopatra was say moving, say at this time over here, she's moving across, and we see that her clock is running slow, and then she comes to rest and stops, and then an hour later she starts up again and she moves at the same speed she was moving before. Will her clock be moving? Will her clock be slowed by the same amount later on? Yeah. Okay. So that's the same thing here, except that we've taken those. You know, here we imagine she was moving at say 5 meters per second, and her clock was going slow, and then she stopped. And then she's moving it later on, she's moving at 5 meters per second, her clock is running slow, and then she stopped. The amount by which her clock is running slow, we agreed, is the same. Doesn't matter whether you're doing the experiment now or later. Now we've just compressed those two together and said she's always moving at 5 meters per second. So her clock should always be moving the same slowness if she's moving at a constant velocity. So when Einstein was drifting across there, we saw that his clocks were moving at a constant rate, slower than the reference clock, but nevertheless at a constant smooth rate, or smoothly at a constant rate. So the distance, so if there's a time dilation of, say, you know, if for Alice and Bob 1 second elapses, or when 1 second elapses for Alice and Bob, say it's, you know, 0.7 seconds for Cleo, then that'll be true anywhere along the line. Time dilation would be constant. Okay, so I just want to point out that this dashed line here, this is the essence of universal time. This dashed line is universal time. Okay, and according to universal time, when Cleo's clock reads 1 second should occur here, but in fact it occurs here. So that's where special relativity breaks with the idea of Newtonian universal time. Okay. Anyways, okay, so let's draw a couple more examples just quickly here. So now we're going to have, say, Da Vinci here, who's going like even faster. So Da Vinci is going faster than Cleo. And so to the right. How do I draw his world line compared to Cleo's? What changes? Yeah. Let's suppose that they're moving at constant rate. So you're right. So if you're accelerating, then there's going to be a curve. But let's suppose that both Cleo and Da Vinci are moving at a constant rate. She's moving at 5 meters per second. He's running at 10 meters per second. So they're both straight lines. What's the difference with Da Vinci? So it's steeper, a steeper slope. Okay, so it's more like that. So in other words, in the same amount of time, Da Vinci covers more ground than Cleo. Okay, and so if Da Vinci's clock reads zero here, where will his clock read one? Will it be higher than this level or lower than this level? Higher, right? Because the effect gets more pronounced. Okay, so this is 1 second, and then whatever, take this, and it's equal intervals here, because we're at constant velocity. Okay, and if Da Vinci is moving at the speed of light, or as he approaches the speed of light, where does the 1 second go? Infinity. It goes way off to there. We have to wait an enormously long time to see Da Vinci's clock go from 0 to 1 second. So his clock gets so significantly slowed that whatever, we just wait forever for it to go from 0 to 1 second. Okay, and final example here would be Eduardo. And Eduardo starts, he's moving to the right, but then he slows down, stops, turns around, and comes back. Okay, how do I draw his world line? Everyone sketch it in the air. Excellent. Okay. So as time goes on, he's initially moving to the right. Okay, so it starts off like that. But then later on in time, he momentarily comes to rest here. Something that's at rest is moving vertically. Okay, as time goes on, there's no motion in space. So it eventually has to become vertical, but then later on, he's actually moving in the reverse direction. So as time goes on, he's moving that way. So now the slope changes to a negative slope. Okay, so it starts with that slope, then it's eventually zero slope, and then that slope. So at the end of the day, it would be a nice smooth curve like that. Okay, so this one here is time according to Da Vinci, and this is time according to Eduardo. Okay. And let's just take one last thing here. So one last point here is that let's suppose that Eduardo's clock reads zero there. Then where should his clock read 1 second, you think, roughly? Let's see. So this slope is about the same as that slope. So let's take this 1 second. So that's about 1 second there. But now when Eduardo is during this portion, this phase of his little trajectory here, he's moving very slowly because he was moving fast here, but then he slowed down. So during this part of his trajectory, he's moving at just ordinary speed. Okay, and so his world line is nearly vertical here. In which case, the separation between tick marks along his world line is going to be very almost exactly the same as between Alice and Bob here, or for Alice or for Bob. So 1 second is about that long. So let's take that over here. So let's put maybe say 2 seconds there. 3 seconds there, and then say 4 over there. So it might look something like that. Okay, so it's stretched out here, but then compressed here, and then stretched out again. Okay, so does that make sense to everyone? Are we all okay with that? Okay, so that's the essence of a space-time diagram. And remember that these are all, the motion is always in one dimension of space. Everything that we're going to talk about over the next couple of lectures with this is all motion along a line. Think of just a bead moving along a straight line, fast or slow or backwards or forwards. Okay, so it's always motion along just one spatial axis, and then we show that motion also in time, which means we end up with a two-dimensional diagram. Okay, and the other general thing to keep in mind is vertical world lines indicate something at rest, okay, because as time goes on, there's no motion in space. Horizontal world line indicates what? Speed of light? Speed of light is finite. Okay, so let me, sorry, that was too extreme. How about this one? So this is someone moving to the right. Okay, this is someone moving to the right faster. They're covering more ground in the same amount of time. This is someone moving even faster. Okay, the speed of light is some finite number. Okay, so maybe, for example, this is the speed of light, c. Okay, and then this would be someone moving faster than the speed of light. This is someone moving at infinite speed. They cover a finite distance in like zero time, infinite speed. Okay, so here is at rest. Somewhere in between is speed of light, and horizontal is infinite speed. Okay, and these are positive speeds moving to the right. These are negative speeds. As time goes on, the person is moving to the left. Okay, those are negative faster, negative speed of light, negative infinity. Okay, so it's important to have that kind of intuitive sense about these diagrams and develop that sense very quickly. Okay, so we're now going to do a little thought experiment. You know, special relativity is all about thought experiments, right? So we're going to start with a very simple thought experiment. And this is an experiment involving sound in air. Okay, so. So we're first going to draw the experiment on in space. And then we're going to draw it in space-time. So here's the experiment. Are you ready? That's it. Pretty exciting, isn't it? Yeah, it's amazing. Whew. Okay. So turns out that the thought experiments in special relativity are always like super simple, but conceptually they're tricky. They're fun. Okay. So this experiment. How would we draw this experiment in space? Well, we would have Alice down here, and well, her arms would be quite long, and they would have several joints. And then she would clap her hands. And then as soon as she claps her hands, what happens is there's a spherical shock wave, a spherical sound wave that comes out in all directions, moving in all directions at the speed of sound. Okay, so that point on the wavefront is moving to the right with speed c. We'll use c for the next little while to indicate the speed of sound in air at rest. And Alice is at rest with respect to the air. And that point on this spherical wavefront is moving, this point here is moving with the speed c to the left. And that point is up, and that point is down, and so on and so forth. So we don't care about all these other points. We just care about this point and this point, because we can only draw a one-dimensional space. Two-dimensional space-time diagrams. Okay, so that's that. So what we are interested in is drawing a space-time diagram for this point on the wavefront, which starts at Alice's hands and moves to the right at speed c, as well as this point, which starts at Alice's hands and moves to the left at speed c. Okay, so we're going to draw that in a space-time diagram. So first of all, just in space, this is Alice's x-axis, that's space according to her. Okay, but in a space-time diagram, we would have two axes, okay? Alice's x-axis as well as a time axis. Okay, so let's draw Alice in this space-time diagram. How do we draw Alice? Straight line up. Okay, Alice is at rest. Anything at rest. So that's Alice. And her clock is going tick, 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 tick. To hear her clock reads 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So here her clock is ticking along here, and she's moving along this world line in space-time. Okay, so that's that. Now, what about this point on the wavefront? Let's suppose that she claps her hands right when Alice's clock reads zero right there. How am I going to draw this point, the space-time trajectory of that point on the wavefront? What's it going to look like? Okay, everyone draw it with their hand up in the air. You get your hands bent, you get it like that, it's a straight line. Okay, so it goes like that. So basically it goes up at some angle. We know that this is at rest, we know that this is infinite speed, so the speed of sound is going to be somewhere in between those two. Now it turns out to be particularly convenient, it would be great if this angle just turned out to be 45 degrees, something like this. Okay, and so the way that we can actually achieve that automatically is very simple. Instead of plotting a graph of things that happen in Alice's space X with respect to Alice's time T, XA and TA, we plot XA versus C times TA. It's a very important, it's a small technical point, but extremely important for keeping things very, very simple. Okay, so why is that? Well, let's see. Why is that useful? Well, suppose that that Alice claps her hand, and then as time goes on, that point on the wavefront moves to the right, and so moves along this world line. Okay, so at some point, at some time later, that point will have moved a distance d from where she clapped. Okay, so the wavefront will be at that point along this world line. Okay, so the question is, when that point on the wavefront has traveled the distance d, how much time has elapsed? In particular, how much time times c has elapsed? Well, let's figure that out. So we have time that has elapsed. Time is distance over velocity. So the distance involved is d. The velocity involved is c. Okay, so that's how much actual time recorded on Alice's clock, tick, 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 seconds or whatever. But c times ta, which is what we're really plotting here, let's see, c times ta, well, that's just c times d over c. And the c cancels out, and you just get d. Okay, so in fact, this is just d. Okay, so this, if we measure this in meters, for example, if d is in meters, like 5 meters, then c times t, this will be 5 meters as well. So if this axis is measured in meters, then this axis is also in meters, because a velocity times a time is a distance. Okay, so we would say this is 5 meters and that's 5 meters. Okay, in which case, obviously, this is 45 degrees. Okay. And for this, this point on the wavefront, moving to the left, how would I draw that world line? Same thing, but other direction. Okay, so up like that. Okay, also at 45 degrees. Okay, and now if she throws a baseball, or so let's say she bowls a bowling ball along here, chasing after that that point on the wavefront, how would I draw its world line? Starts at the same time here. She rolls the bowling ball at exactly the same time as she claps, which is, she actually has three hands. She's kicking the bowling ball. Okay, she boots the bowling ball and it rolls along here. And less than the speed of sound, because she's not that good of a kicker. So how do we draw that? Okay, so it's this kind of thing. So this is subsonic. And now if she works at the gym like crazy and she can kick it supersonically, it would be here. Faster than the speed of sound, slower than the speed of sound. Okay, so that's that. All I wanted to mention here, and this is an extremely important point, is that CTA has the dimensions of length. It's a length, just like XA is. So both are lengths. So what we're really, at the end of the day, doing is we are measuring spatial distance along the x-axis in, say, meters, using a unit of length. We are also measuring time. We're not interested really in t. We will always be interested in c times t. We're also measuring time in terms of length, in terms of meters. Okay, so it's always it's very much like this. Here's x measured in meters. Here's y measured in meters. And I can give, say, the position of some point or the distance some point is from some other point in terms of meters. I can say go 4 meters in the x and then 5 meters in the y. Okay, and so our x and y diagrams, whenever we draw two-dimensional diagrams, we always use the same units for x and y. We are actually now doing something very similar here. We are using the same units for time as for space. We're using meters, okay, just by this conversion from t to a distance by multiplying by c. Okay, so this is not only just a technical simplification with all the equations, as we're going to see, but it's hugely important philosophically. So I mentioned this, or you saw that space-time cube there, okay, where Einstein unified space and time into something like kind of like a space-time cube, where space-time is sort of this thing, is one sort of whole. It's a whole, just like you can't really separate x and y here. They're just two different directions in a two-dimensional plane. Here, space and time are just two different directions in a two-dimensional plane. Okay, but in fact, it's four-dimensional. Okay, so it's like this cube, four-dimensional cube, where one aspect of the cube is space, or three aspects of the cube are space, and one is time. But they're all measured on the same footing. Okay, you can't, you know, space is measured in meters. You couldn't have space measured in meters and time measured in seconds. They wouldn't. I mean, those are like apples and oranges. They wouldn't be part of the same thing. So you measure both of them in meters. Okay, so that was so this goes a long way, at least formally, to seeing that in fact space and time will become unified, will become part of a whole. Okay, part of one unified whole. Okay, let me just go through one key sort of thought experiment here before we take a break here. So is everything making sense so far? Got to check, you know. Okay, so thought experiment. So this thought experiment will be conducted in the context of sound waves in air. And then ultimately, and so it'll tell us something about how to calculate Doppler shift for a siren and all that kind of stuff, which isn't very interesting. But why we're doing this is the exact same thought experiment is what we're going to apply to light in vacuum. And then we're going to add into the mix Einstein's principles of special relativity, and we're going to discover something pretty freaky about the nature of space and time. So ultimately, this thought experiment will tell us what the true nature of time is. Okay, so but bear with me, we're just doing something simple. It's starting out with just air, sound waves in air. Okay, so here we go. So the experiment again is pretty simple. Okay, so we start with Alice, as usual. And the experiment consists of Alice is standing here at rest with respect to the air, and Bob is moving with respect to the air. He's moving at he's walking past her at a constant rate. So he's just walking like this, doom, 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 doom. Maybe he's looking back at Alice. And then what Alice does is when Bob has moved some distance away, okay, on her clock, she measures, say, 10 seconds or something. Bob is some distance away. She claps her hands like that. And then a sound wave goes chasing after Bob. Okay, since Bob is moving at less than the speed of sound, it will eventually catch up with Bob. Maybe it catches up with Bob here. Okay, then the sound wave hits Bob and reflects back to Alice. So maybe he's got a board like this. He reflects the sound wave back. Or maybe as soon as he hears it, he like screams out, "Alice, I heard it!" You know, and so, but his brain reaction time is like that, instant. Okay, no brain processing time. Just bang, bang. Okay, so that's the idea. So Alice is at rest, Bob drifts like this, and from the moment Bob crosses her path, she zeroes her clock, she waits maybe 10 seconds or some finite amount of time, and then she sends a sound signal chasing after him. It hits him, and it bounces back to Alice, and she records how much time it takes for the sound wave to get back, there and back. So basically, it's like a Doppler shift. It's like a radar ranging kind of experiment. Okay, very, very simple experiment. Let's now draw that experiment, well, first in space here. So here's Bob, and Bob is moving with some velocity v like this, constant velocity just drifting past her. She claps her hands, you know, Bob is down here, sound wave goes after and bounces back. Okay, so it's hard to draw that diagram in space there. So that's why we have space-time diagrams. So let's draw that in space-time. Okay, so the horizontal axis is space according to Alice, as far as Alice is concerned. And Alice's world line, we always start with Alice's world line. So Alice's world line, Alice is at rest. We're taking the point of view that she is at rest. So her world line is just vertical like this. Okay, and this is time according to Alice times c. Everything is time is always times c. Okay, and let's see, this is the speed of sound. Okay, so if Alice were to clap her hands at t equals 0 here, that's the world line of that sound wave would move like that. Okay, so how are we going to put Bob's world line in there? Where's Bob's world line? Okay, so above the speed of sound, so it's somewhere in here. And let's suppose that Bob crosses Alice's path when her clock reads 0. So his world line is something like that. Okay, so he's just doing this. Let me get it. Okay, so this is actually Bob's world line. His clock is ticking away, tick, 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 along his world line. And Alice's clock is ticking away along her world line, like this. Okay, for the moment, we're not interested in what we will be eventually, Bob's time along his world line. Okay, so for the moment, though, we want to just represent this thought experiment on this diagram. Okay, so what Alice does is she's got her clock here. Bob crosses her path at this time. So he walks by her like this, and then she waits a certain amount of time on her clock before clapping her hands. Okay, so let's suppose that she waits an amount of time, capital T. Okay, so we're not plotting times, we're plotting C times time. So this will be CT. This will be in meters. Okay? So we got that. And then she sends, she claps her hands here and sends out a sound signal, which is traveling to the right at the speed of sound. How do I draw that? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, for example, suppose that the speed of sound were just 1 meter per second, just for simplicity. Then when we say she waits 2 seconds, it's really 2 times 1 meter per second, or 2 seconds times 1 meter per second is 2 meters. So we're really plotting 2 meters here. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to draw this sound signal that she sends out. She emits the sound signal here. What does it do? Where does it go? Parallel to the dotted line to the right. Okay, so it's at 45 degrees, like this. And then it hits Bob, and then it's reflected back to Alice there. So first question is, so this angle here, well, we know this angle. So it's not really a question. This is 45 degrees. Okay. So that's pretty clear. So just by plotting CT versus X instead of T versus X, we're guaranteed that that's 45 degrees. Alice is at rest with respect to the air. Okay. So that's that. Now the key question is, when this sound signal comes back, at what angle do I draw that sound signal coming back from Bob? Or a more direct question is, with what speed does Alice measure? Or what speed does Alice measure for that sound wave coming back? So remember, Alice is at rest with respect to the air. Bob is moving with respect to the air. She claps her hand. That sound signal travels through the still air like this. Bob's got a big board here. He reflects it back. Either that or he claps his hand as soon as he hears that signal reach him. Okay, so he's basically moving along like this through the still air. And then he claps his hands like this while he's in motion with respect to the air. That sound signal goes back toward Alice. With what speed does Alice measure that sound wave? Speed of sound?
No.
Okay, so So here's Bob. Suppose that Bob is drifting with a speed V to the right like this. And then he claps his hands like this while he's drifting to the right, and he sends this sound signal back. And the question is that speed that Alice is going to measure back here when it gets back here, is it going to be C? Is it going to be C plus V? Is it going to be C minus V? Is it going to be D? Or what's it going to be? So how many would say, how many say C plus V? Zero. How many say C minus V? Okay, so that's about a quarter. So 10 people. How many say C? Okay, that's about 20. So 10 plus 20 is not equal to 40. So we got about that, I guess. Okay, so more of you think C. So for those who say C minus D, can someone explain why? Of the C minus D group? Okay, let me just talk about this, because this is an extremely important point. The correct answer is C. Okay, this is the correct answer. But understanding why is very, very important. And the reason why is just some basic physics. And it's very important that you understand this reason why. Otherwise, everything I say after this in special relativity won't make any sense. Okay, well, I mean, it'll make sense, but you'll be wondering, you know, why is he harping on that? Quit harping on that. That's what you're gonna be wondering. Okay, so I'm gonna be emphasizing a certain point, and that point is deeply connected with this. The answer is C and not C minus D. See, the answer why is it C? Well, the answer is one way to think about it is here's Alice over here, and here's Bob. And Bob is in motion with some speed V like this. And in between Alice and Bob are air molecules. These air molecules are at rest with respect to Alice. And the process by which a sound wave propagates from one point to another is sort of like dominoes. How many of you are familiar with the game dominoes, have ever heard of the game dominoes? Okay, almost, okay, excellent. So the key is basically with dominoes, what you do is you set up a whole bunch of little wooden blocks like this, wooden rectangles. And they're getting worse looking rectangles as I go. Okay, so there's a bunch of rectangles like this. And what you do is you tip this first rectangle like this, it bangs with that one, it bangs with that one, bangs with that one, and by sort of a chain reaction, all these dominoes tip over, and the speed at which they tip over is a function of whatever, the properties of the dominoes and their size, their height, all of that stuff. Anyways, the point is, when Bob is moving along, he's moving with respect to those dominoes. But when he claps his hands, what is he really doing? What he's doing is just basically, so he's moving like this. He claps his hands like this, and then his hands move out of that region. Where his hands clap together like that, what he's done is just sort of at that instant, he's jiggled some of these air molecules around. He's moved some of these dominoes around. Okay, and then once that happens, then this domino effect is set up. This air molecule, which is at rest with respect to the room, bumps into that air molecule, which also is at rest with respect to the room, and then jiggles a bit, and then bumps into the neighboring air molecule at rest with respect to the room, pushes it over, and so on. So this effect of the sound wave propagating from here to there is just like dominoes, but it's with respect to all of these air molecules that are at rest with respect to the room, or these dominoes that are at rest. So the fact that Bob is moving or at rest is irrelevant. He just is moving, he's just going like this, and his clapping, whether he's in motion or not, just disturbs one of those dominoes. And then after that, he just moves out of the region entirely. But once he's disturbed one of those dominoes, that domino takes, that disturbance takes on a life of its own. Okay, it knocks over the next domino, knocks over the next domino, and so on down the line. But the speed with which that effect is propagating is just the ordinary speed of sound in air, regardless of how fast he's moving. So you can think of it as he's at rest, he claps his hands and knocks over that domino and goes like this, or he's like running really fast and then happens to tip that domino. Okay, it doesn't matter. Now that he's out of the scene, this wave has taken on a life of its own and it moves, it propagates through the air with the speed of sound with respect to still air. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, so how many say C minus V? Excellent, zero, okay, right. This is very, very important. Okay,
So having said all of that, let's see if this would just take us 5 minutes, and then we'll take a break. One thing I didn't say here. Oh, okay, let me just finish this diagram, and then we'll take a break. Okay, very important part of the diagram missing. Okay, so having established that, what we've established now is that the sound signal coming back from Bob, even though he is in motion with respect to the still air, Alice will determine that the speed of that sound wave is just still c, the ordinary velocity of light of sound with respect to still air. Okay, and so this is also 45 degrees. That's crucial. That's the crucial thing to understand about this. Okay, so having said all that, now we can just put a couple of finishing touches on this, and then we're done for the moment. So first off, what do we need here? Oh, so somehow we need to get, how should we do it? Okay, let's do this first. We need to get Bob's velocity in here somehow. Okay, so first off, one question that we can ask is, how far did Bob travel away from Alice by the time at the moment that he received the sound signal from Alice? Okay, so how far did he go? Well, that's basically from here to here, or from here down to here. So what is this distance d here? How much distance did he cover in the time since he passed Alice's position? Well, okay, so d is, distance is velocity times time. Okay, so to, I should have put this one here first. First of all, if this distance is d here, the fact that this is 45 degrees and that's 45 degrees means that the distance from there to there is what? Also d. Remember, this x is measured in meters, ct is measured in meters, this axis is also in meters. If that's 5 meters, that's 5 meters of time, and that's 5 meters of time. That's also a crucial point. Is that clear to everyone? Because that's why it was so important to establish that these are 45 degrees, so that whenever you draw a distance like that, you can immediately translate it from horizontal to vertical. The distances translate the times very simply with 45 degree trajectories. Okay, so distance is velocity times time. Well, let's write, what is the velocity? What is Bob's velocity? Well, let's suppose that to be. What is the time that we're talking about? Okay, from the time that Bob crossed Alice's path to the time that he received the light signal, the sound signal. Okay, so what is the time involved for that, according to Alice? CT plus D, so it's this time. So according to Alice, Bob crossed her path at this point over here, and then moved further and further and further away, received the sound signal at that point, which is that point on her clock. So the time elapsed for Alice is simply CT plus D. That's C times the time, so we need to divide by C to get the time. Okay, so we have that. So this is a this is an equation. D is equal to some junk and a D in there. Okay, so we need to solve this equation for D, and I'll leave that for you to do. So D then turns out to be, actually what we want is the ratio of D to CT. So I'll leave this as an exercise. D over CT turns out to then be V over C divided by 1 minus V over C. Okay, so that's a very important formula that we're going to use repeatedly. Okay, so we'll call that equation number 1. And finally, the last question that we want to ask here, and here's the crucial question. Okay, so all of this so far is very, very straightforward. All of this is just simple, straightforward physics. I mean, in a different context, you might not have thought about this before. You might need to think about it a bit, but it's pretty straightforward. now, the final question we want to ask is, how much time elapsed for Bob between this time and this time? Suppose that this is, like, say, 7 seconds. Then, according to Newton's idea of universal time, when 7 seconds elapses for Alice, 7 seconds elapses for everyone else in the universe. Okay, and so the answer, the time from here to here, is obvious. It's just 7 seconds. Okay, but we know that that's just an assumption. Okay, we know that that's not necessarily true. And so what we do is we say, okay, well, suppose we actually don't know how much time. Suppose we don't simply assume that it's just automatically 7, but we allow it to be something else. Okay? And so what we do is we say, well, we don't actually know what it is, but we know that for sure it's going to be proportional to Alice's time, or let's say proportional to this time, CT. So this amount of time, we're not going to assume necessarily what it is immediately, but it's proportional to, so it's K times CT. So it's some proportionality factor K that's unknown times CT. So why does that make sense? Well, let me just sketch this over here. This is our setup in sort of a simplified picture. This one's gotten pretty messy here. Okay, so here we have CT, and we're asking, what is that time there? Well, suppose that we were to double this. Take CT and double that. So this is 2 times CT is the total distance here. Okay, and Alice sends the light signal, the sound signal. So this dashed line is at 45 degrees. That dashed line is at 45 degrees. If the time from here to here is CT, and we double that from here to here, what happens to this time from here to here versus here to here? It also doubles. So they're just similar triangles, right? So the point is, whatever this time is, if I double this time, I will also double that time. So whatever this time is, it must be proportional to CT. Okay. Is that clear for everyone? Okay. So it's proportional to CT. We don't know what this proportionality constant is. And that's going to be our key focus of attention when we come back after the break. What we're going to do is we're going to try to determine K based upon two approaches. The first approach will be we will determine K simply assuming universal time. If 7 seconds elapses for Alice, well, that must be 7 seconds. Then it'll be easy to determine K. And that K will then be related to the Doppler shift, the ordinary Doppler shift with sirens and air and all that kind of stuff. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take this whole diagram, and we're going to, instead of dealing with sound in air, we're going to translate it to just pick it up and transpose it over to light in vacuum. Okay, and then we're going to apply Einstein's ideas. And so instead of assuming universal time, we're going to assume Einstein's principles of special relativity to determine K. And we're going to discover the relativistic Doppler shift. Okay, and with that flows all of the weird results of special relativity. Okay, time dilation, length contraction, the relativity of simultaneity, all that stuff will then follow out of that. But what I'm trying to do is build a case for special relativity, try to understand the logic behind special relativity in a way that you're, at the end of the day, you're going to say length contraction, time dilation, relativity of simultaneity are obvious. They have to be like that. If they weren't true in our universe would be truly an odd place. Okay? Length contraction, time dilation, and all that stuff are present in order to make our universe simple and obvious and natural. Okay, so that's the goal. All right. So why don't we take a break in the bistro there? Or the break is okay. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. So what? Okay. Let's do some questions. Okay. So we have some fantastic special relativity questions here. So why don't we just do like last time? I'll just hand them out, and then at the end of the time you can pick them all up.
Let's just try to get through a little bit more of this special relativity. So first I want to ask you, this is what we got to before the break. For how many of you, do you have any problems with this diagram? Is everyone okay with this? It's really important. This is
our basic sort of starting point. And everything that we're going to do is going to follow from this. So if there's anything that's unclear about this picture, about this thought experiment, you know, we've got Alice at rest, Bob is walking by her, she claps her hands after a certain amount of time, it gets reflected back, hits Bob, gets reflected back, she times how long it takes, you know, the total time to get back, all that stuff. The key point is that the sound signal that comes back from Bob, even though Bob is a source in motion, the speed of that sound wave coming back is still c is still the speed of sound relative to the air. Alice is at rest with respect to the air. And the speed and that sound wave from Bob travels through the air, through the air at rest. And so she will measure, Alice will measure the standard speed c. So not only is this 45 degrees, that's 45 degrees, which means that if that is b, that's b, that's b, and then we derive this simple relationship. Okay, which relates the distance Bob travels to the time that Alice waits on her clock before, you know, clapping her hands and sending that sound signal out. Okay, so that ratio turns out to depend upon, the velocity of Bob with respect to speed of sound, c, in that simple relationship. Okay, so this is all really, really basic physics. If it doesn't make sense to you, just stare at it and it will. There's nothing odd or strange about this. Okay, so what we're going to do now is, at the end of the day, we ask the question, well, how much time elapses for Bob? According, if we make the assumption, yeah. Yes, that's right. So here that equation has a little bit of a problem when Bob's speed approaches the speed of sound. So the denominator here, is that what you were talking about? Yeah, so the denominator is going to go to zero, and so this expression will go to infinity. And so why is that? Well, that's just because let's sketch the diagram as Bob approaches the speed of sound. So here's the speed of sound. And suppose that Bob is going very close to the speed of sound. He's like this. Then Alice sends her signal like this, parallel to this, and it gets bounced back. And so this distance d and this time ct, the ratio of d to ct is going to go to infinity. Right, that's what it's saying. And the key thing to realize is that as Bob goes closer and closer to the speed of sound, this t basically goes to zero for a fixed d. Just look at the shape of the curve, so the shape of the diagram. So if Bob is moving slowly, that'll be B, that'll be CT, and that'll be D. So now as Bob goes faster and faster and faster, we have D getting essentially longer and CT getting shorter. D getting longer and CT getting shorter, because this line is parallel with that line. No, Bob could, so that's not a problem. So it just says that that if Bob is moving at the speed of sound, then in order for that light signal, for that sound signal to catch up with Bob, Alice has to emit that sound signal at exactly the time that Bob crosses her path. So wait no time at all. That's all that it's saying. So Bob can also go fast. Well, sorry, but if he does go fast, no, you're right. If he does go faster than the speed of sound, then it's a bit of a problem because here he is. The whole idea of the experiment is Bob goes like this, Alice claps her hand, and then that sound wave catches up to Bob, and then he reflects it back. But if he's going faster than the speed of sound, that sound wave will never catch up with Bob. However, it doesn't mean that the formula breaks down. So if Bob is going faster than the speed of sound, then 1 minus v over c will become negative. And so all it's telling you is that, assuming that d is positive, that t has to be negative. That Alice has to, emit the clap before Bob actually reaches her position in order to catch up with it. So, I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about all of this, you know, in the language of mathematics, just push it. You know, where are the singularities? What happens when you go past the singularities and so on? And think about physically what that corresponds to. And there's always some interesting, typically some interesting stuff that comes out of an analysis like that. Okay, so, totally clear? Super. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to try to determine this constant k. And as I said just before the break, we will determine that constant under two conditions, or using two approaches. One, the first approach is to simply take Newton's assumption of universal time. When 1 second elapses for me, 1 second elapses for everyone in the universe, regardless of their state of motion or where they are in the gravitational field or whatever. If we assume that's the case, then we can derive k, and the k that we get will just be the non-relativistic Doppler shift for sound in air. Okay, so let's do that. Let's see how that comes out. So we just assume universal time. So 1 second for Alice is 1 second for Bob. So 7 seconds for Alice is 7 seconds for Bob. Okay, so this time is the same as this time. That's all that it's saying. Okay, so that it's telling us that this length, CT plus D, must equal KCT. And from that, we immediately get what K is. Okay, so that tells us that the universal time tells us that CT plus D must be K times CT. Okay. So let's actually rewrite this slightly. So that's T, just dividing both sides by C. That's T plus D over C is KT. Okay, so we'll call that equation number two. So let me just reemphasize the nature of these two equations that we've boxed here. This first equation is just generally true. Okay, so there's no assumptions here. This is just an obvious fact of this simple thought experiment. Okay, this equation here is not obviously true. It's not always true. This equation depends upon an assumption. This equation depends upon Newton's assumption of universal time. 1 second for me, 1 second for everyone. Okay, so they're of a different kind of nature. But anyways, if we take these two equations now and combine them together, so 1 and 2, what does that tell us? Well, we can solve for k. There's a d over t, and we can divide both sides by t and get a d over t and solve those equations. I'll leave that as an exercise for you. And you find out that k is equal to 1 over 1 minus d over c. Okay? And so we notice that this proportionality constant, this proportionality constant k, which we didn't know before, it depends upon the velocity. I mean, obviously, if Bob is going really fast, this value of k might change. It might depend upon the velocity. And we see, in fact, that indeed it does. It depends upon the velocity, actually the ratio of Bob's velocity with respect to the speed of sound. And k goes to infinity when Bob is going at the speed of sound. And basically, this is a Doppler shift, and that's because it's been shifted to zero frequency, as we'll talk about in a second. Yeah. Oh, well, it depends upon what you mean by, so you're assuming that this diagram has a geometry. So sure, if this were xy space, and we were assuming Euclidean geometry, then, and we had a triangle like this, then to say that length is that length, that would violate the triangle inequality in an obvious way. But because we're saying CT here, so it is absolutely true that this space now, space-time, has a geometry, and we're going to be talking about that, but it isn't Euclidean geometry. Yes. So in fact, in Minkowski geometry, this side here, if that's say 5 and that's 3, then this will be 4, for example. So this side, while it appears to be the longest in the diagram, is actually shorter than that side. Okay, so we'll come across that shortly. Okay. So, But there's still a relationship between the sides. Very important point. There still is a relationship, but it's not the one you're used to. But it's just as good of a geometry. Okay? It's just as useful of a geometry. It's just as genuine of a geometry as Euclidean. This is a different kind of geometry, which allows for things like when these side lengths approach equal, if that's 5, 5, that'll be 0. That has a length of 0. And that's when time, basically, time dilation is extreme, something moving at the speed of light, there is no passage of time relative to another observer. Yeah. No, K is not the Lorentz constant. So the Lorentz constant, I think you're thinking of this one, or one over that. Yeah, so this is slightly different from that. And we'll show the relationship of K to Lorentz constant further. Okay. So all we're doing here is sound and air, nothing spectacular here. What I want to do now is just interpret the K that we have here in terms of the Doppler shift. Okay, so it's easiest to understand this in the context of sound in air. And then when we get the relativistic Doppler shift, you'll see how to interpret it as Doppler shift for light. Okay, so here we go. So K has Doppler shift. So this is just the Doppler shift of sound in air, like from a siren. So here's our space diagram. We've got Alice here at rest. So we're looking at things from her perspective. And what she's doing is she's emitting a sound wave. She's singing a tone. La! Not like that. And it is at some frequency, FA, frequency according to Alice. So when she's singing la 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 la, right? Then she's timing the frequency according to her watch. This is her watch, frequency according to her watch, all that kind of stuff. Okay, cycles per second. And this wave is moving to the right with a speed c, the speed of sound in air, Alice at rest with respect to the air. And Bob is running like this with some speed v. Okay, and what we need to know is what is the frequency that Bob hears? Okay, so Bob hears some frequency. So this would be frequency according to Bob. Is frequency according to Bob less than or bigger than frequency according to Alice? Less. Okay, so here's a source of sound that's at rest with respect to the air, and here's something in motion receding from that. And so the frequency should be less. So frequency Bob should be less than frequency Alice. Let's find out exactly how much less. Okay, so how would we draw a space-time diagram of this situation? Well, let's see. So first of all, we got Alice in there. So that's where we usually start. So there's Alice's x-axis. And then we draw Alice's world line. Since we're taking the point of view that she is at rest, that world line is just vertical. Okay, so there is, let's just call it t. Normally we do ct, but let's just draw that for simplicity here. So time according to Alice is up here. This is the world line of her clock. Her clock is going tick, 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 tick. And that's the history of her clock. Okay. And let's see, Bob is over here somewhere. Bob's time axis, so his clock is going tick, 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 tick. And we're actually under the assumption of universal time here, so that when 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for Bob. And we have the violation of the triangle inequality. So now let's try to get this sound wave, which is traveling from Alice over to Bob, let's try to get that in the picture. How are we going to do that? So what we want to do is we want to put this sound wave somehow in this picture, put the information about this sound wave in this picture. So, well, let's look at two I mean, what these space-time diagrams are good for is showing motions of particles or motions of points. Well, let's take this point of the wave crest, which is actually, let's take this point, start with this point. This point of the wave crest, which starts back here and gets sent out. Okay, so this point of the wave crest, let's say, is emitted right there. Okay, that just leaves Alice's mouth at that point. And then it goes over toward Bob, and since Alice has emitted this sound wave, since Alice is at rest with respect to the air, then this sound wave is just moving with the speed c relative to Alice. And so it just goes off. Okay, and it hits Bob at that point, it hits his eardrum at that point, okay, according to Bob's thought. Okay, and then a little bit later, she then emits this wave crest, okay, and that wave crest, say, emitted at this point over here in time, and it makes its way over to Bob and hits Bob's eardrum over there. Okay, now the crucial thing, we want to compare frequencies, but these axes are time. How do you convert time to frequency? Inverse. So a frequency is number of cycles per second. The period between these waves is a number of seconds per cycle. Cycles per second, seconds per cycle. Okay, so this time here we'll call TA is 1 over Alice's frequency. Okay, so this is the time between that wave crest being emitted and then that later on that one. Okay, so that's the time according to Alice's clock over here. And then that just goes over here. And what we want to know is, what is the time here? Time elapsed for Bob. Well, the time according to Bob, here's our picture here. The time according to Bob is going to be, this is the same kind of situation where you have an interval along Alice's world line and an interval along Bob's world line separated by two 45 degree lines, except that this 45 degree line here is compressed to 0 length. Okay, so just take this picture over here and extend it over to the right. Just move Bob over. Okay, then we would have that. Okay, so the point is, now that diagram is extremely messy. The point is that if according to that diagram there, if an amount of time TA elapses here, then the time according to Bob, TB, is going to be K times TA. That factor of K is used properly in this context here. Okay, is that clear? Okay, super. Okay, so what does that tell you? Well, we have a relationship between the time between Bob receiving two wave crests and the time between Alice sending those two wave crests. But we want a relationship to frequencies. Well, that's just the inverse. So the frequency that Bob hears is 1 over TB, which is 1 over KTA, which is 1 over K frequency according to Alice. And 1 over k, we figured out k somewhere up there, is 1 minus d over c. Okay, so we get the frequency according to Bob is some number times the frequency according to Alice, and that number is that thing in parentheses there. Okay, so obvious cases. As soon as you get a formula like that, the first thing you do is plug in different extreme cases. One case is when B is 0, tells you that FB is FA. When Bob is at rest, frequency that he hears is the same as the frequency that Alice hears. Okay, that was simple. When V is positive, so Bob is moving to the right, but less than the speed of sound, 1 minus V over C is a number that's less than 1. So frequency that Bob detects is less than the frequency that Alice hears it being sent at. Okay, so he hears the pitch lower. Okay, what if V is negative? If V is negative, that corresponds to Bob running to the left. Okay, if we make V negative here, then it's 1, and we add a positive quantity to 1, and so this number is bigger than 1. So when Bob is running to the left, V is negative, frequency according to Bob is bigger than frequency according to Alice. It's higher pitch. lower pitch running this way, higher pitch going this way, same pitch pointing at that red. What happens when V approaches C? Then this just becomes 1 minus 1 is 0, and the frequency according to Bob is 0. Does that make sense? Okay, I mean, basically, Alice is sending out this wave train, which is moving like this, and if Bob is moving less than the speed of sound, those are just as an apple at rest, those wave crests are washing over his ear, bang, 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 bang. Okay, but if he's running at the same speed as those wave crests, well, then he's just sort of maybe caught, his head is caught like right there, for example, at a pressure maximum, okay, you know, or a pressure minimum, I guess it's just as bad. But it's just basically caught at that pressure, that constant pressure, and he doesn't hear any like changes, and he doesn't hear anything, any sound kind of flux vibrations. Okay, so what if V is bigger than C? What is this? Negative. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, like backwards. So he would be hearing it going backwards. So you know, she's singing this beautiful, you know, happy birthday, some lullaby, coming in backwards. So does that make sense? That we should be heard backwards? Okay.
Sound waves if the sound waves don't reach him, how does he hear?
Oh, well, let's just imagine that that Alice has been singing for a very long time. And so the entire x-axis still regular sound waves. And then he can adjust his speed, he can get rest and just hear it normally, or go that way and hear a lower pitch, or go faster than the speed of sound and actually hear what she needs some prior to that, but in reverse.
Yeah. So would like you have to go like twice the speed of
Yeah, that's right.
It's like you'd only hear the song before, like she sang it first and then he ran by faster than speed, like after she sang it.
Yeah, she would have to have sung it first and then moving faster than the speed of sound, he actually catches up with that pulse of, like it's a whole wave train that's maybe this long, moving along. And then he catches up with it moving faster than the speed of sound, and he hears it, you know, the end of it first, followed by the beginning.
Okay. And then, but he started singing after he ran by.
Yeah, then he just leaves. Well, see, now that's interesting, okay? The fact of the matter is, and I want you to pay attention to this later on, and I'll point it out. If I don't, I'll just point it out now, but forget.
That's cool.
The equation in special relativity, like the relativistic Doppler shift, is a 1 minus V over C, 1 plus V over C. I don't remember if it's 1 over or not. It must be like this, something like that. Okay, and so the idea of going faster, so same deal, if V goes faster than the speed of light, if V is faster than the speed of light, then this becomes negative, and then put you have a square root here now. So for just an ordinary sound wave, classical sound wave, you got a negative, which means it was going backwards. But here you get an imaginary, you get a square root of negative 1, and so it's not possible. It's just then it's really telling you that it's not possible to go. That's consistent with the idea that it's not possible to go faster than speed of light. Okay. Okay. So now what we want to do is
we want to replace this whole sound in air with light in vacuum. Okay. So all of the stuff that we've talked about here is just going to be easily transplanted from one to the other, and then we're going to add Einstein's two principles upon which he based special relativity, and we're going to come up with a new understanding of in particular time, but also of space. Okay, so space time. All right, so let's see. Replace sound with light. So light is a tricky sort of thing, and when just thinking about special relativity and learning about it and so on, there's these different Part of the confusion is, what is the nature of light? Is light like a wave in some material medium, like wave in ether, like Param was talking about yesterday? Or is it a particle in vacuum? And what model of light do you take, and so on and so forth? So this often leads to all kinds of confusion. So what I want to try to do is just, I want to try to keep it as simple as possible. I want to imagine, I want to start by imagining that light is a wave in ether, in the way that people in the 1800s thought. Okay, because it's sort of setting the stage for, you know, well, what did Einstein do, and what world was he living in that he was trying to address? So everyone knows in around 1800 or 1801, Thomas Young did some experiments with light, which indicated that light behaves like a wave, has wave-like properties. Okay, and just sort of in a nutshell, what that meant is that physicists start to think, well, okay, what other waves are we familiar with? Well, we're familiar with sound waves, which we know are vibration of air molecules. So what's waving in the case of sound waves is air molecules back and forth. Water waves is just, you know, water waving up and down. So what's waving in the case of water waves is the water. Okay, so then they thought, well, light waves. Well, what's waving in the case of light? And so they didn't know. And so they invented some material medium called the ether, which was, the idea was that it somehow pervades all of space. It's some elastic medium, just like jello or something like that. And light consists of, you know, like hitting the jello over here, and then just like dominoes, that jello effect ripples through. And that's what light is. It's this jello, this ether jello, jiggling back and forth. Okay, so that's what they imagined that light is. What's waving is the ether. Okay, so that's all very fine and well. And so what we're going to do is we're going to imagine that's what light is, just for sake of argument for a little bit. Okay, so assume, what is light physically? Assume light is wave in ether. Okay, and in complete analogy with sound in air. Okay, so. So what that means is that this diagram that we drew here, we can transplant exactly. It's identical. This is just really weird. Wave and ether, so exactly like sound and air. Okay, go away. Okay, so we can just take this we just take this diagram and just recopy it over here. So we've got okay, so we imagine that Alice is at rest. So same deal. Alice is at rest with respect to the ether, and instead of clapping her hands, she's got a little laser light that she clicks on and off, laser pointer. And Bob is running with respect to the ether with some speed v, less than the speed of light for ether. Okay, and when Bob crosses Alice's path, Alice starts her stopwatch ticking. When a certain amount of time T has elapsed, she sends she clicks on her little flashlight or her laser, and she sends a light signal chasing after Bob. Since Bob is moving faster than the speed of light in that ether, that light signal is eventually going to catch up with Bob, and it's going to be reflected back. What's really crucial here is that this is now 45 degrees. And that's true for the same reason as it's true for sound in air. Okay, same as for light in ether here. Okay, so we've got that. So even though Bob is in motion with respect to the ether, when he clicks on his flashlight, then he jiggles the ether, and then that jiggling of the ether takes on a life of its own, and it moves from one little element of the ether to the next, the next, the next, at a speed that is c with respect to the ether at rest, and Alice is at rest with respect to that ether, so that's 45 degrees, which means if Bob covers a distance d in that amount of time, then that's d as well, and that's d as well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all the same arguments apply, and we have this equation over here, this equation 1. So we still have that d over ct is v over c minus, or divided by 1 minus v over c, where c is now the speed of light. Okay, so what's going to change is equation number 2 here. We're going to make a different assumption. We're not going to assume universal time. We're going to introduce Einstein's principles, and we're going to replace the assumption of universal time with the assumptions that Einstein made about which are the two principles on which he based special relativity. And the fact of the matter is that the assumptions upon which which Einstein based his theory of relativity are much more believable than the idea of universal time. They're much more natural, and they're much more, yeah, the universe should be that way. Okay, so that's what I want to that's what I want to get to, and and considering there's a great deal of confusion when it comes to especially Einstein's second principle, which is the principle of the constancy of the speed of light. So oftentimes you will hear that the speed of light, that Einstein said that, oh yes, one of the principles upon which special relativity is based is that the speed of light is a universal constant. Well, that's not true. That's not what Einstein said. Okay, what Einstein said was something a little bit more careful than that. He said, I'll read what he said, and then, so this is from his 1905 paper, and before I actually read this, the actual constancy of the velocity of light statement, let me preface that with what he said earlier. So he says, let us take a system of coordinates in which the equations of Newtonian mechanics hold good. In order to render our presentation more precise and to distinguish this system of coordinates verbally from others, which will be introduced hereafter, we call it the stationary system. Okay, so all he's saying is that let's suppose there exists a frame of reference, so some kind of state of uniform motion or whatever in the universe, in which Newton's equations hold true. Okay, which means that, you know, an object not undergoing any forces will move on a straight line, and, you know, F equals ma applies and all that kind of stuff. Let's suppose there exists one such frame, and let's call that the stationary frame. Then he says, principle number 1 is principle of relativity, which I'll get to next time. Principle number 2 is the principle of constancy of the velocity of light. And he says, any ray of light moves in the stationary system of coordinates with the determined velocity c, whether the ray be emitted by a stationary or by a moving body. Okay, so let's paraphrase that. Okay, so that would be, we would write that as, so principle 2 on which special relativity is based, speed of light. So I'll just write this down, we'll talk about it for a few minutes, and then we'll break. Okay, so it says, so we would paraphrase it like this. For an observer at rest, okay, so here's how we would write it. So Einstein is simply saying that for an observer at rest, okay, at rest in quotes, because, of course, at the end of the day, in special relativity, we know that one of the ideas is there's no such thing as absolute rest. So at rest, what Einstein is referring to by that is his idea of this stationary frame. So he says, this, let's suppose there exists one frame in the universe in which Newton's law is full of good. We will call that the stationary system. And then what he's saying is a light ray moves in the stationary system of coordinates with a determinate velocity c, whether that ray be emitted by a stationary or a moving observer. Okay, so moving body of light. So for an observer at rest, the speed of light is c, independent of the motion of the source. Okay, I want you to we're kind of running out of time here, but I just want you to appreciate that this is really an obvious thing. That this is really a very, very simple and very, very believable statement upon which to, you know, proceed, upon which to base a theory. I mean, what you're looking for something which is you want to base a new theory on some principles. And those principles are obviously should be believable. They should obviously be things that you would think are natural and believable and obvious about the universe, or at least something that you would like to be that way, or you'd like the universe to be that way. It would be a simple universe if indeed it were that way. Okay, so this is in fact a very, very believable statement. For example, it's true for sound waves in air, okay, as we've just talked about this afternoon, right? For an observer at rest, so at rest with respect to the air, so Alice at rest with respect to the air, the speed of sound is c, independent of the motion of the source. Whether Bob is moving away or toward Alice, if he emits a sound wave by clapping, that sound wave moves with respect to the still air and moves with the speed c with respect to the still air. Alice detects the speed c with respect to the still air. Regardless of the motion of that source, the speed of sound is independent of that motion of the source. Okay? And there's a whole bunch of other reasons which I'll go through next time as to why that's believable. I just wanted to just point out the opposite here. If we were to take this statement here and we interchange the words observer and source, we would say, it would say, for a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer. Okay, that's completely ridiculous. You see that? How that's totally ridiculous? Okay, so let me just point this out. So on the one hand, we have, suppose we're thinking of sound in air or light in ether. Okay, so here it is. And the first statement says, for an observer at rest, the speed is independent of the motion of the source. So here's my observer at rest, and here's my little flashlight here, my source of sound or my source of light. Regardless of how that source of light moves around, the waves that are coming from it are moving with respect to that still ether, where this guy's at rest with respect to that still ether. And so this guy, Alice here, is going to measure the speed c independent of the motion of the source. Okay? Whereas if we were to switch that statement around, okay, and we were to say for a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer, well, that's just really freaky. I mean, that's like saying I've got a flashlight over here, okay, and I'm at rest with respect to that flashlight, and I have, you know, a ruler here, and I have a clock here, and you know, a pulse of light comes from this flashlight. I measure how long it takes for that pulse of light to cross across my my meter stick, I time how long it takes, I determine the velocity. Okay, so I determine the velocity of that light signal from that source. Now, if we were to switch the word observer and source, it would be like saying that I would measure the speed c even if I was that same speed c, even if I were running toward the flashlight or away from the flashlight. I mean, that's just crazy. There's a flashlight there, I measure a speed c. If I run toward that flashlight, there's no way I'm going to measure speed c. I'm going to measure c plus v, right? If I run away, I'm going to measure c minus v. There's no way that this statement makes any kind of sense if you switch the word source and observer. Okay, so Einstein was very careful to state it this way, in a way that was completely believable, and that works for sound in air, for light in ether, for light as a wave in ether, and so on and so forth, so that it would be totally believable to the physicists of his day who were reading his paper and saying, yeah, what's this guy saying? Oh, yeah, that's, they would say, you know, principle number two, yeah, obvious. Principle number one, relativity, yeah, obvious. We'll talk about that next time. That's obviously something we would like to be true. But when you put the two together, well, then all kinds of sparks fly. Then you realize that, whoa, this is freaky. We have to change our basic understanding of what space and time are. And so Newton's idea of universal time had to get thrown out and so on and so forth. But the point is that special relativity is based on two principles which are very believable and very, very natural. Okay? It's only when you combine them together that you get really interesting consequences, like a deeper change in our understanding of what space and time are.